case this morning is number 06-1050, BCS Insurance Company against Guy Carpenter and Company. Mr. Perlman.
Good morning. May it please the court. There are four independent bases upon which the district court must be reversed. First, the district court applied the wrong statute of limitations in this case. Second, the district court applied the wrong accrual analysis to BCS's tort claims. Third, the district court failed to apply the discovery rule to all of BCS's causes of action. And when it did apply the discovery rule, it improperly drew significantly disputed facts and improperly drew inferences against the non-moving party instead of for the non-moving party. Finally, the district court misapplied the law of implied indemnity. The Producer Statute Limitation Act at issue in this case applies to insurance producers involving policies of insurance. It does not apply to reinsurance intermediaries involving contracts of reinsurance. Insurance producers and insurance policies have distinct meanings under the Illinois Insurance Code than reinsurance intermediaries and reinsurance contracts. Insurance producers are governed under Article 31 of the Illinois Insurance Code. Reinsurance intermediaries are governed under the Reinsurance Intermediary Act, Section 100. Insurance producers are not governed under the Reinsurance Intermediary Act, and likewise, reinsurance intermediaries are not governed under Article 31 of the Insurance Code, which governs insurance producers, insurance representatives, and limited insurance representatives and registered firms. Guy Carpenter is not an insurance producer. Guy Carpenter's parent company, Marsh & McLennan, is an insurance producer. Guy Carpenter is not governed or regulated under Article 31. Guy Carpenter is regulated under Section 100, the Reinsurance Intermediary Act. Conversely, their parent, Marsh McLennan, would be governed under Article 31.
Mr. Perlman, let me just ask you this. Was there a written contract between BCS and Guy Carpenter that outlined Guy Carpenter's duties to procure insurance?
As required by the Reinsurance Intermediary Act, there's what's called a broker of record letter, which is a very brief outline of what the Reinsurance Intermediary Act requires that a reinsurance intermediary provide to its client.
Well, in this letter, was there anything that stated that Guy Carpenter would ensure that BCS was adequately reinsured?
Well, I think that letter, again, outlines what the Reinsurance Intermediary Act requires, but there are common law duties that brokers owe to their insurers that go beyond whatever is included in a broker of record letter, which leads to the next point regarding the accrual analysis.
Well, but first, wouldn't that mean if there isn't that... this is basically just a contract claim rather than a tort claim arising out of an extra contractual relationship?
No, it's not. In fact, I believe that in Illinois, and as the case law in Illinois has recognized, both in Broadnax and in the cases Cantor that Broadnax cites, and a 2006 case, County Mutual, they recognize that claims against an insurance broker by an insured are extra contractual in nature, that relationship arises, that's a special relationship, and the law imposes special duties of competence, professional competence, that arise outside of a contract. The relationship is not, in fact, defined by the contract, but rather by the common law, which, again, is why I believe the district court erred in concluding that these are torts arising out of contract. I'm not sure how you can conclude that you have a line of cases that says that the contract does not define the relationship and that these are extra contractual tort duties in a line of cases, and yet the district court finds that these are torts arising out of contract, citing to one case, Indiana Insurance Company, which Broadnax distinguishes. saying this is a totally different relationship. They say it is significant. That was a relationship between an agent and an insurer. This is a relationship between a broker and an insured, and that was a significant distinction to the court in Broadnax. If the court accepts that the Insurance Producer Limitation Act does not apply to this case, we need not address the rest because we have a five-year statute of limitations. And I submit that the court has to do that. When you look at the session law at issue here, it did three things. It amended the statute of limitations with respect to insurance producers. It amended Article 31, and it amended the Consumer Fraud Act. And under the doctrine of in pari materia, you have to read insurance producer in that session law consistently in all three of those statutes. And when you do that, Article 31, one of the things that the session law did was it increased the fees that insurance producers pay by 1,000%. That was part of the quid pro quo. Reinsurance intermediaries don't pay fees under Article 31. Under Section 10G, they pay fees under Section 408. So it would not make any sense at all. It would be against the intent of the legislature that reinsurance intermediaries would get the benefit of a shorter statute of limitations on the one hand, but not pay the 1,000% increase in fees because they're not subject to fees under Article 31, and that would violate in pari materia. On the accrual, it is our position that, again, these are extra-contractual tort claims under Broadnax and Cantor County Mutual. Under a tort claim, you cannot have accrual until there was an injury. There was no injury in this case until June of 2000 when the reinsurer stopped paying BCS's reinsurance submissions.
Now, in Guy Carpenter's short appendix at page 28, there is a letter that's dated June 11, 1998, which states BCS is worried that they may be sued by the underwriters to get to ISI. So why wouldn't that mean that as of at least June 11th, 1998, BCS knew it had liability for ISI's mishandling of the claims?
Well, first, I'd like to point out as a factual matter, this is a letter from the reinsurer's representative, not from anybody from BCS. But putting that aside,
no, I know
there is a distinction between BCS acknowledges that it was in the middle of this relationship. That is a very different issue than whether they would be liable. What BCS was saying, and if you look at the language, they say in order to get to ISI, if the reinsurers, they're not saying that BCS is concerned that they may ultimately have liability. They're saying they don't want to be stuck in the middle, and they want the reinsurers to be able to go directly against ISI.
Yeah, but they're worried about being sued, whether they're at the front end, the middle end, the end end, right?
They're worried about being part of a suit. I don't know that this is not a BCS letter, but this is the distinction between what BCS is trying to do, being in a reinsurance context. BCS and Guy Carpenter were in agreement. At this point in time, if we look in June of 1998, what we have is the reinsurers are paying 100% of every reinsurance claim submitted to them for every year. They're not withholding a penny. $30 million. At this time, Guy Carpenter is telling BCS the reinsurers are controlling the program. They're taking care of ISI. At this time, BCS and Guy Carpenter were working on draft treaty language, not the slips, not the outline. Those just state certain clauses, the total detailed treaty wording. And if you look at page 11 of our reply brief, that language, and this will address Your Honor's question, that language at BCS, if you look at how they modified it, it would have said the reinsurers agree to follow the fortunes of BCS in any and all respects and without limitation. Thus, all acts performed by the administrator, ISI, which are binding upon BCS, shall also be binding upon reinsurers. Full stop.
Could you explain to me just what ISI does?
ISI is an insurance They have clients who purchase auto warranties, computer warranties, things of that nature. They sell those warranties. BCS fronts. They provide the paper because they're licensed. And the reinsurers took 100% of the risk on all of those liabilities. And ISI get all the claims in on the warranties, and they administer them. Thousands and thousands of small transactions.
So they have adjusters and other things that go look at the whatever the claim is and then, well, I guess, approve it and then turn it over?
ISI does that.
Yes.
They hold back some of the money from the reinsurers. They financially pay those. The reinsurers audit at ISI. The reinsurers had representatives who were in control of ISI. Getting back to Your Honor's question, so there's a difference here between BCS may be a necessary party in litigation because of privity, but they weren't going to have the ultimate liability. The reinsurers may have needed them to be in a lawsuit, maybe as a plaintiff, maybe as a defendant, maybe what have you, but it didn't get to, ultimately, the reinsurers were looking to ISI and responsible for all actions of ISI. Nonetheless, if you look at Stone Container from the Seventh Circuit, and you look at Broadnecks, there is not an insurance case that we're aware of where you can find that a cause of action accrues before the insurer has denied coverage. Prior to June of 2000, the reinsurers had not denied coverage. They sent a letter in June of 2000 saying, we will not pay any more accounts after June of 2000.
They give a reason?
They don't give a reason. They just said that would be the last. I think they say that there's disputes and that we we're not paying any more claims after that. But that is the first time that the reinsurers denied coverage to BCS. Up until June of 2000, they now paid $39 million, I believe. Prior to that time, not only Guy Carpenter was working on the treaty wording, the reinsurers were fully performing. BCS was fully performing. BCS was cooperating with the reinsurers. If the reinsurers were disavowing this, and BCS knew about it, in this June of 1998 time frame, why did BCS then transfer all of the claims to the reinsurers and allow the reinsurers to pick a new administrator if BCS wasn't under the impression that the reinsurers, in fact, controlled it and would be responsible for the administrator's actions, and that Guy Carpenter had secured the very coverage BCS had thought? The other thing to keep in mind is there's no direct evidence. Guy Carpenter never said to BCS, hey, you don't have the coverage that we talked about in this draft treaty wording that you forwarded to us in 1998 saying the reinsurers would be unconditionally bound. A reinsurance intermediary has a duty to either secure that coverage or tell you that they didn't. And we never heard anything from Guy Carpenter in that regard. In fact, Guy Carpenter, through 2000, through 2001, continued to tell BCS. There's tons of evidence in the record, which the district court ignored. They ignored all the evidence from BCS, saying where Guy Carpenter is telling BCS, the program works exactly the way we've talked about. The reinsurers are responsible. The reinsurers are on the hook. The first time Guy Carpenter changes that position, tells BCS differently, actually, is in connection with this litigation. I see I'm into my rebuttal time, unless there's other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Perlman.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Mr. Menton.
Mr. Minton, forgive me, before you even begin.
Yes, start in on me.
This is on a purely administrative matter.
Yes.
Would it be possible for you to submit a more readable copy of your short appendix, page 27, the Hold Harmless and Assignment Agreement?
I think we have many copies here. Would you like one of my colleagues to hand you one now?
That would be great.
For these purposes, we'll just see what we can find in terms of a better one. Of course,
I don't want to cut into your time, but I couldn't read that.
Apologize. I hope you read the very last page of that appendix, which is page 32. That will be the key one.
That's the only page that I couldn't read.
It's So if my colleagues can find one, they will hand one up to you, and otherwise we'll do it immediately after
argument. Thank you.
So there are essentially two questions that the court needs to address. One, the applicability of the insurance producer statute of limitations. That's a two-year statute of limitations. If it applies, BCS has a huge problem on its hands. After all, these events occurred in 1996, and here we are in 2006. If it doesn't apply, they get a five-year statute, and they have a much less huge problem because there was an intervening tolling agreement. Does the two-year statute of limitations for an insurance producer apply? And what we have is a dispute between BCS on the one hand, who says insurance producer and reinsurance intermediary, two totally different things in the law of Illinois. One is one, the other is the other. Therefore, if you're an insurance producer, you're not a reinsurance intermediary. If you're a reinsurance intermediary, you're not an insurance producer. Guy Carpenter is a reinsurance intermediary. Too bad. And on this technical argument, notice how it leads to a very odd result, a very odd and impractical result, which is that the sophisticated insurance company, buyer of reinsurance, gets a five-year statute of limitations to sue its broker, while the consumer of insurance, dealing with its automobile insurance broker or its homeowner's insurance broker, gets only a two-year statute. Does the Illinois statutory scheme require that very odd and counterintuitive and, I would submit, wrong result? And the fact is that the Illinois statutory scheme doesn't require it at all, doesn't even suggest it, and in fact is just the opposite. There are a lot of things I could point to. We cite many things in our brief, but the two key ones. Notice that we're dealing with a statute of limitations in the Code of Civil Procedure, which has the word insurance producer in it. Should that include reinsurance brokers as well as insurance brokers or not? Two things to think about. One, do you notice with my adversary's argument how terribly technical he is that insurance and reinsurance are two totally different things when it comes to the statute of limitations, but when it comes to accrual, they're the same, right? When it comes to accrual, all the accrual cases he cites are insurance cases. They're not reinsurance cases because we all intuitively think that insurance and reinsurance are the same thing for most purposes. Shouldn't they be the same thing for a statute of limitations? Should we apply licensing distinctions for this purpose? So that's my first point on why insurance and reinsurance should be the same for the purpose of the statute of limitations. Now let me give you point two. We're dealing with two statutes of significance. The reinsurance intermediary statute passed 1991, and the insurance producer statute of limitations passed 1995. And I'm going to read to you, I noticed one of the judges actually has some of these Illinois statutes there, but here I have in my hand the Reinsurance Intermediary Act, which for purposes of licensure defines what you have to do in Section 100/10, Title 215. And this, by the way, this is the ground that the district court primarily relied upon in coming to its conclusion that the two-year statute of limitations applied. Licensure. This is in the Reinsurance Intermediary Act. No person, firm, association, or corporation that maintains an office, officer, director, agent, or employee, directly or indirectly, in this state, shall act as an intermediary broker unless licensed as an insurance producer in this state. So in defining what license a reinsurance intermediary has to get in the state of Illinois, the Illinois statute uses the word insurance producer. And then Guy Carpenter world's largest reinsurance intermediary, with an office in Illinois, applies for a license, and it gets a license, and the license reads reinsurance intermediary. But the statute says the license you must have is insurance producer.
You're saying they were operating without a license then?
I'm saying either they were operating without a license, or the correct answer is that the Illinois Insurance Department believes that a reinsurance intermediary is a subcategory of insurance producer. And that is the only reasonable answer that a person can come to.
Is it just a gap in the law and that we have to fill that in?
I don't think it is a gap in the law. I think that the normal, natural reading of insurance producer would include reinsurance producer. In other words, for all the reasons that we cite in our brief, the word insurance includes reinsurance as a subcategory. Now, it turns out that there are examples in the law and in the many volumes of Illinois insurance regulation and of other states, there are many examples where reinsurance and insurance are distinguished. And for particular purposes, they may well be distinguished, although under the Illinois insurance regulatory scheme, insurance and reinsurance are not distinguished for the broad core purposes, corporate governance, financial responsibility. I'm sorry.
Did you finish your thought?
I wanted you to get a chance.
Okay, well, I was just wondering whether, in this debate regarding whether the Insurance Producer Liability Act statute of limitations applies to reinsurance, I mean, what I've been wondering is whether it matters that Guy Carpenter was neither an insurer or a reinsurer, but rather a reinsurance intermediary.
Right. It's not an insurer, meaning an insurance company. In other words, it doesn't provide the insurance or the reinsurance.
Right.
It is the broker, like a real estate broker. Right. So, but insurance producer, that is a term, a term coming out of the NAIC, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, where they have attempted to get what used to be called brokers, agents, and intermediaries into one word. So an insurance producer is an insurance broker, and a reinsurance intermediary is a reinsurance broker, which either is or isn't a subcategory of insurance broker. That's what is for you to decide. But for the reasons that I have submitted, I think not only the normal, natural reading, but also the inevitable conclusion from the statutory words, where the word insurance producer is used to define reinsurance intermediary by the Reinsurance Intermediary Act, one is very hard-pressed to say that a reinsurance intermediary is not a subcategory of insurance producer under this act. And therefore, that reinforces the natural conclusion one would have that in a statute of limitations it should apply to both. I want to move on to the accrual issue. Mr. Perlman made a statement on his argument that he also made in his brief, which is that they can't find any case law where a cause of action against an insurance producer, that is a broker or insurance broker or agent or intermediary, accrues before the denial of coverage. We found one and cited it in our brief from the Northern District of Illinois just last year, Judge Gettleman, where that occurred. That's the Equity Residential case. And there is the Stone Container case in the Seventh Circuit from 2003. Interestingly, we have two of the three panel members from that case here with us today. And it was Judge Evans who wrote the opinion, so I don't know how much involvement you may have had or how closely you read it, but in the Stone Container case, I hope you had a lot of involvement. The Stone Container case at page 511 contains a survey of the law of other jurisdictions on the time of accrual. And then over at 512, the Stone Container case says, well, the other jurisdictions don't teach us a whole lot, so we're going to go with the formula for accrual in the Hermitage case from the Illinois Supreme Court. Okay. In the survey from other jurisdictions, there are, and I can't claim to have read every other case, the Seventh Circuit survey, but there's at least two where the accrual of the cause of action is before denial of coverage, and that's Arkansas and Nebraska. They're the first two cases there. I'm going to tell you that I agree with the Seventh Circuit Stone Container case from 2003 that the other jurisdictions case don't give you a lot of help because the discovery rules and other collateral rules on how accrual works don't track from state to state, and so you don't get a lot of help. So in the Stone Container case, Seventh Circuit panel, including two of you honorable people, adopted the statement of accrual, not on torts arising out of contract relations, but on for all torts, general torts, from the Hermitage case of the Illinois Supreme Court, which reads, the plaintiff knows or should know that he has been injured and that his injury was wrongfully caused. So that is the statement from the Illinois Supreme Court taken by this court in the Stone Container case. And
so does this require some knowledge of what was going on at ISI? What then, if it's not when they denied coverage, what is the event that would...
Well, I'm going to tell you the event the district court found, and I'll read it to you. It's the Judge Grosvenor was mentioned one of the documents, but there's an even more definitive one, which is page 32 of the Guy Carpenter special appendix attached to the back of our brief, and which we then quote from at page 31 of our brief. Now, this one is written by a guy named Doug McLean. Doug McLean is the in-house counsel of BCS. So, well, we did cite another document written by somebody else, but there was a back and forth between Judge Grosvenor and Mr. Perlman on. This one, I would submit, is the most definitive. It's the next to last page behind our brief, and the last paragraph reads, in any event, as part of the agreement to transfer the administration, oh, this is June 5, 1998, BCS will require an additional agreement with the reinsurers, an additional agreement with the reinsurers. Under this agreement, BCS will assign to the reinsurers BCS rights to any and all causes of action it has against ISI relating to ISI's administration of any business that was reinsured by the reinsurers. In exchange, the reinsurers would agree to hold harmless BCS from all liability for losses, damages, etc., that have resulted from ISI's administration of such business. So here, in this one letter, June 5, 98, and if the cause of action accrued on this day, everything is swept away.
Well, does it matter at all when BCS knew that ISI was mishandling claims, or does it just matter when BCS knew that it was underinsured?
It may be both, Your Honor, but this statement, what I just read you, says he knows that ISI has mishandled claims in the past, and he knows that he doesn't have insurance for it because he says BCS will require an additional agreement. So he knows he does not have coverage for it. And by the way, this argument that somehow they were supposed to get, quote, insurance coverage for their agent, ISI, screwing up is an odd argument, but it doesn't really go to the statute of limitations. But one would think, do you really think you have insurance coverage for your own agent screwing up? But here, in this document, BCS says we will require an additional agreement. So they are saying we know we don't have that, and we require the agreement to cover losses from that have resulted from ISI's administration. That is, we know there are losses, and they're already in the past, on June 5,
1998. What about the ITT Linden business? Did BCS have reason to know it wasn't insured for that until that arbitration in March?
The arbitration was in 2002. So BCS makes an effort toward the back of its brief to separate out this ITT Linden as somehow being different in kind from the rest of the matter, so that maybe if the court rules for us on, or for Guy Carpenter on the other pieces, it will preserve this small piece. But I would submit that there is nothing different about ITT Linden from the other pieces in terms of the accrual of the statute of limitations. It is ITT Linden is one piece of the business. It is business that the claims administrator paid and submitted to the reinsurers. It is business that the arbitrators found was not covered by this contract, and they found that it was not covered by this contract by reading the contract, and one can read the contract, and it does not say that ITT Linden business is covered. So,
yeah, but if we take the facts in the light most favorable to BCS, Guy Carpenter assured BCS that it was insured for the ITT Linden business.
Well, there is no affidavit on the underlying motion where some witness has said that. So the question then becomes, does the contract, the cover note, which is the contract between BCS and the reinsurers, which does not say that ITT Linden is covered, even though the prior reinsurance agreement did say ITT Linden is covered, is that definitive that they should have read the contract and known, or is it not? I mean, whether that's a genuine issue of material fact is obviously for this panel to decide. However, it's a tough circumstance for BCS, I would submit. I should address briefly the implied indemnity issue, because implied indemnity, it will be a brief discussion, but implied indemnity is a theoretical way out for BCS, even if there's a two-year statute, and even if accrual applies, as we contend and as the district court found. Because an implied indemnity accrual doesn't indemnity accrual doesn't occur until you actually pay something. So that would be the way out. Now, the problem with implied indemnity for BCS is that implied indemnity, the classic or only case for implied indemnity, is where a principal has been found liable for the wrongdoing of its agent. The principal is completely innocent, and the principal goes back against that agent whose wrongdoing it was. Problem for BCS here is that BCS has been found liable for the wrongdoing of one agent, but that's ISI, but it's suing another agent, which is Guy Carpenter, and as against Guy Carpenter, BCS is not the innocent principal. BCS has to take responsibility for the wrongdoing of its other agent, ISI. So when one attempts to apply the innocent principle, last sentence, when one attempts to apply the innocent principle rule of the Illinois case law, one runs into this problem, and that's what the district court found. That's
well, basically what you're saying is that PCS had the authority to monitor ISI and so should have had the some responsibility, if not complete responsibility, for ISI's action. Isn't that what you're saying?
Well, correct. ISI is BCS's agent. In fact, the first document in our supplemental appendix behind our brief there is the BCS-ISI contract. The first line of it is BCS hereby appoints ISI as its agent, and it goes on from there with a lot of rights for reviewing the books and many other things.
Thank you, Mr. Menton.
Thank you very much.
You have 7 minutes remaining, sir.
With respect to the statute of limitations, I submit that counsel, his entire interpretation that insurance producer means reinsurance intermediary and a reinsurance intermediary is a subset, is completely against everything that insurance reserve says. It says in Illinois, insurance and reinsurance have distinct meanings. And in fact, if we go through the Illinois insurance code, many sections say insurance, other sections say reinsurance, and yet other sections say both. If you can just interchange those words whenever you want, you rewrite the insurance code. And in fact, the treatise that Guy Carpenter cites for the proposition that insurance is a part of reinsurance is just a part of insurance goes on to say in the very next section, what they don't cite is in Illinois, citing to the reserve case, the Supreme Court case of reserve, says that there's this distinction. And when you say reinsurance, you mean reinsurance. When you say insurance, you mean insurance. Moreover, it makes no sense. If an insurance producer in the Intermediary Act means that reinsurance intermediaries are insurance producers, they're governed by Article 31 in all of its provisions and the Reinsurance Intermediary Act, and you can't be. You cannot be. It may be that there are people who are insurance producers and reinsurance intermediaries, and when they're acting as an insurance producer in that capacity, they're governed by Article 31, and when they're acting as a reinsurance intermediary and they have the proper licenses, they're governed by the Reinsurance Intermediary Act. Any other conclusion runs afoul of reserve, in para materia, and the code itself, which draws distinctions. It would go against all statutory construction.
Your opponent talks about a policy. The policy, he says, is counterintuitive or something where the sophisticated insurers, I guess plaintiffs, have a longer statute of limitation than the little guy who buys insurance. I don't know if that policy is good or bad or whether it makes any difference, but I'd like you to comment on it.
But my response to that is statute of limitations are typically thought of the class protected as a class of defendants. You know who the defendants you're trying to protect are. The plaintiffs could be anybody. It could be a consumer. It could be a sophisticated company. There are plenty of sophisticated insurance companies that Marsha McLennan represents. The class of defendants that when you read the legislative history here, they were trying to protect the small mom-and-pop guy selling a State Farm policy, an auto policy, a homeowner's policy. That's what they're trying to do. In exchange, there's going to be continuing education requirement changes and increased fees. But to focus on the sophistication of a plaintiff in a statute of limitations policy analysis, to me, makes no sense. It's focusing on the wrong party.
Well, it's inverted. I wondered about that, but yeah. I just wanted to at least address it.
The policy consideration is who the defending class being protected is.
Yeah.
Why protect? So, taking that a step further, Guy Carpenter, the largest reinsurance intermediary in the world, doesn't need protection, but the guy selling a homeowner's policy does. That's who they were trying to protect. That's clear from the session, from the floor debate. I want to get to this issue on accrual and this hold harmless agreement that Guy Carpenter's talking about. That needs to be taken in context. What the district court did and Guy Carpenter did is there is an extensive record here. There are many explanations of what was going on at that time and why there are other explanations for that hold harmless agreement. We've talked about that in our brief. The record is vast. This is a motion for summary judgment. disputed issues should not be decided, and inferences have to be drawn on our behalf. At that time, Mr. McClain, in the June time frame, he had just sent them the language for the reinsurance treaty that said the reinsurers will be unconditionally bound for the acts of ISI. That's what the reinsurance was supposed to do. Now you have the reinsurer saying we want to move these claims, and you have a third party not related to anything we're talking about here who comes in and says you can't do that because we have some of those warranties and we said ISI was supposed to do it and we're going to sue you, BCS. And BCS says, well, the reinsurers control this because that's what Guy Carpenter is telling us. That's what we believe. We want an indemnity and hold harmless if we're going to move those claims because we're being told we're going to be sued in connection with that wholly unrelated thing. It has nothing to do with the reinsurance in this matter at all. And the reinsurance provide that. And BCS is trying to get as broad a hold harmless as they can because they don't want to be sued. And if they're sued, they want to be indemnified. That said, that is a wholly different issue. And we have expert testimony on this. The record is clear on this. If Guy Carpenter has simply told BCS, had documented the coverage that BCS sent to them and that they had agreed to, that the reinsurers would be unconditionally bound by whatever ISI did, that was adequate reinsurance. If we don't get the indemnity, the broadest indemnity and hold harmless that we wanted, that doesn't change the reinsurance. And the reinsurance doesn't give us an indemnity and hold harmless. It just gives us reinsurance. They are not the same. That is taken totally out of context. There are other explanations for it, and the inferences drawn from that must be drawn on our behalf. And the district court doesn't address that. And if we look at what's happening in that time, the reinsurers did not even reserve their rights. Forget denial of coverage in 2000. They didn't reserve their rights until April of 1999, almost a year later. And with that reservation of rights came a check for $3.6 million, 100% of the reinsurance claims. How is it that BCS didn't have the reinsurance they thought when the reinsurers hadn't even reserved their rights yet and sent the check for $3.6 million? If that's not a factual issue, then I don't know what would be. I don't know how BCS could have known they didn't have the reinsurance they thought. They did not get the broad indemnity and hold harmless that they were seeking, but that is a totally distinct issue. Thank you.
Sir, your time has expired. Thank you, Mr. Perlman. Thank you, Mr. Benton. The case will be taken under advisement.
Then just send something that I can read.
Before we counsel departs, would you, with respect to the document that Judge Rovner asked for a clearer copy, this creates a problem for us. We would appreciate your consulting your master file and seeing if you can't come up with a better copy than this.
Get that to you this afternoon?
Sure. I'll give this back to you so you can see what is unreadable.
Thank you, counsel.